MechCast, Wednesday, March 5th, 2013. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We've got a bunch of great stories and topics and things to get into and discuss, as well as a bunch of great feedback from you. I got a bunch of audio feedback in this episode, and I always enjoy being able to share that with you. So hang in and stay tuned for all of that. But before we get started, I do want to take a moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that is GoToMeeting by Citrix. You know, in business, it's amazing when you can get your entire team together, you can really get a lot of stuff accomplished. You know, projects that have been dragging on for weeks, decisions that can take days of going back and forth through email to get decided, all of those things, all of those delays can get solved in one simple face-to-face meeting right then and there. The trouble is that these days, that can be tricky, sort of getting everybody together in a single location. It can be inefficient, it can be time-consuming, it might even be impossible to kind of coordinate everyone's schedule depending upon where they are, right? So many of us work virtually, people are in different locations, and that is where GoToMeeting with HD Faces comes into play. It solves the issue, making it easy to get your entire team, everyone together online. It doesn't matter where your team's located, you can get together when and where you need to. GoToMeeting is simple to use and offers powerful features. You can share your screen and documents so everyone can stay on the same page, literally stay on the same page. HD video makes it feel like you're all in the same room, even when you actually aren't, and it makes it so easy and simple to launch or join a meeting from anywhere. You can use your computer, you can use your smartphone, you can use your tablet, you can even present from an iPad. I actually use GoToMeeting with my clients all the time. I'm able to do chats and meet with clients who are located everywhere. I have some who are just down the street. I actually don't have a physical office, so GoToMeeting makes those meetings possible. I also have ones who are across the country or even all over the globe. I have a couple clients who are in Australia. So I am able to work and meet with clients everywhere. It really is able, allows me to expand my business outside of just my local area. Plus, it saves me time because I can see them, I can share documents, and if there's trouble understanding an interface or a process or something I'm working on with them, I can share my screen, I can show them exactly what I mean, or they can show me their screen and show me where they're stuck on a particular interface or something like that. I really want you to give GoToMeeting a try. You can do it free for 30 days. Don't wait. For the special offer, just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and then use the promo code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T. Just remember to use the promo code MACCAST when you sign up, and you'll get a free 30-day trial. And a big thank you to GoToMeeting and Citrix for their support of the MACCAST. So when Apple added the iTunes in the cloud features to iTunes, it really sort of changed the way that I thought about purchasing media from Apple and through iTunes. I'd always done music, but once they enabled those features for movies and TV shows, it opened it up for me to begin to start to buy more, especially movie content on iTunes. I had always been leery before. I stuck with buying DVDs because I was always afraid of having to back up those large movie files. But now that Apple has movies in the cloud, at least in the US, for being able to re-download that stuff, I feel more comfortable buying movies direct from Apple, and I've expanded that. Well, this week, Apple added the ability to re-download movie content purchased from iTunes 11 to more countries, 11 more to be exact: Belgium, Cyprus, Denmark, Finland, France, Greece, Luxembourg, Malta, the Netherlands, Norway, and Sweden all got that capability and now have access to the service. The update is for movies only, except for in France, which also gained the ability to access iTunes in the cloud for TV shows. So that brings the total number of countries with access to iTunes in the cloud services for movies up to 80. And now Australia, Canada, the UK, the US, and France have access to iTunes in the cloud for TV shows. So Apple is working on expanding that service. I had no idea that they had 80 countries available for the iTunes in the cloud movie service. That's pretty good. I'm sure Apple eventually wants to get all of the areas that they have movies and TV shows available for sale into the iTunes in the cloud services. But you know, as you could imagine, that's got to be a daunting task. Like, I think they pretty much have to work with the different studios, and there's different regulations in different countries and things like that, and you got to work out all those deals and the licensing and stuff like that. So nice to see them rolling forward with that service a little bit and expanding it to more countries this week. It's been another week, and there are more Java updates. Apple and Oracle released an emergency zero-day Java patch just this week. As a matter of fact, just today on Wednesday, late in the afternoon, Oracle released an emergency patch for Java SE 7 Update 17. For the Java browser plugin, it addresses two vulnerabilities. Then Apple quickly followed suit by updating Java SE 6, which is the version that Apple installs on OS 10 if you've enabled Java. And that will prompt you through software update to install that. Apple's latest update is called Java for OS 10 2013-002, so the second one for this year, and it's available for Mac OS 10 10.7 or later. It's assumed that the Apple update is the same fixes or addresses the same vulnerabilities that were released in or addressed in the Oracle update, which came out earlier in the day, I think. So if you haven't seen those show up, you probably want to open up, if you're online, Apple's software update utility and run that, or you're going to want to make sure that you open the App Store and run your updates from there. That'll get you Apple's updates for Java SE 6. If you've installed Oracle's version of Java, you're going to want to run their tools or go to their website to get the latest updates for their version of Java. But man, Java seems to be under attack as of late. Fortunately, I think a lot of us don't have to run Java. I do it for Crash Plan, which is why I have Java installed, and it's a great service, and I'm happy to keep patching. You know, as long as we stay on top of these things and keep patching them, as soon as these exploits are discovered, most of us should be able to remain relatively safe. But it's kind of becoming one of those chores we got to stay on top of. Luckily, it looks like Apple and Oracle are being pretty responsive on these security patches. So we'll just keep an eye on it and stay safe out there. The developers over at Panic, the makers of cool software for the Mac like Transmit and Coda, they're always up to some cool things, and they have a great blog. If you haven't ever seen it, head over to panic.com, check out their posts and stuff like that, but they're always messing around with cool stuff. And this week they were playing around with some of the video out capabilities of Apple's latest iOS devices, the Thunderbolt devices, or excuse me, Lightning devices. I get my two connectors mixed up, Thunder and Lightning. But they noticed something curious that they reported about on their blog. They were sending video out signals via the Apple Lightning AV adapter using video mirroring, and it was yielding less than 1080p resolution. They noticed the resolution output was 1600 by 900 instead of 1920 by 1080. And worse, they were noticing that there were sort of compression artifacts in the resulting video images, which you wouldn't assume that you would see in an HDMI video output. You wouldn't notice those things coming from a pure digital signal. So they did a check using the old 30-pin dock connector on an older iPad, the 30-pin AV adapter, and they noticed that they did get 1080p 1920 by 1080 video. And according to the iPad mini tech specs, it did claim that it should be able to output up to 1080p video out. So they were looking at this and looking at these images and things like that and going, okay, what's going on here? There's something funky. And so what they decided to do was literally take a hacksaw and hack apart the adapter. And when they did that, they found that the board in there and the chips in there contained a little tiny ARM silicon on a chip processor that had 256 megabytes of RAM. And regardless of the hardware, the net result was that the connector was not sending out 1080p video, but it was streaming compressed video internally. And the conclusion was likely what was going on was that because the Lightning connector has just 9 pins, that Apple was not sending a raw HDMI signal to the HDMI connector on the adapter. And so they posted this on their blog, and it prompted some conversation and some more exploration by a bunch of smart people. And there was a comment that showed up in the posting, supposedly from an Apple engineer, and explained that the deal was that the Lightning connector just can't stream a raw HDMI signal since it's basically just a serial bus. And what it meant was that with the Lightning connectors, all of the adapting is actually done in the adapters themselves. And the reason Apple's doing that, or one of the reasons Apple's doing that, is it opens up the possibility to build almost any adapter, because really you're just dealing with a straight serial connection and then handling the adapting within the adapter itself. So in the case of the HDMI video adapter, what they're doing is they're using the H.264 encoding technology in the iOS devices to generate an output stream that then they can fire down the Lightning serial connection to the adapter, and then that little ARM processor in there is dedicated to just decoding the packetized data and then sending that out as the HDMI signal that ultimately ends up on your screen. And unfortunately for now, that results in a small loss in quality, but it was a compromise Apple was willing to make for the versatility of the connectors and the Lightning technology, and plus the future proofing, because they don't have to worry about the adapting. You know, it's just these raw signals. They can build any kind of an adapter they need. And so today that might be, you know, an HDMI video adapter, or it might be a FireWire adapter, it might be an Ethernet adapter, whatever it is. And if some new fangled connector comes out in the future, they supposedly would be able to pretty easily, with software and some chips, develop the adapters they need. So essentially, it allows Apple to output to any device on the planet, irregardless of the endpoint of the bus, HDMI, DisplayPort, and any kind of future inventions or iterations. And the poster also claimed that the adapter firmware is stored in the RAM on that. You remember I mentioned it has 256 megabytes of RAM. So the firmware is stored in the RAM, meaning that it will be updated, or according to the poster, it will be updated in the future if they can figure out how to improve the quality a little bit. And he claims that there's people already working on that. So they're aware of these little artifacting issues and are working to improve that, and supposedly could push out a firmware update for the adapter, which is just a weird thing to think about. But interesting story nonetheless. And if you, like I said, Panic writes a lot of really cool posts up on their blog, and if you haven't been following it, you might consider popping over there and checking it out. The rumors around the next iPhone, the iPhone 5S, are beginning to heat up, and it's looking like we may be able to buy one sooner than later. Back in January, Jefferies analyst Peter Misick told his investors that Apple might begin production on the next iPhone as soon as March, with a possible June-July release date. Now the Japanese blog Mac Takahara is reporting that Foxconn is beginning to move the iPhone 5S into production. They claim there is very little in terms of design changes on the new device, saying that they will even use the same production lines that they've been using for the current generation iPhone 5. Mac Takahara also believes that the iPhone may be getting ready to finally come to Japan's biggest carrier, NTT Docomo. They say that NTT Docomo has apparently reduced orders of Android phones for the fall 2013 season, and that could be a sign that they're making room for the iPhone coming to the carrier's network. So that would be a pretty big deal. KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo also pegs the new iPhone launch for the July timeframe. He expects the announcement from Apple to about iOS 7 and the next generation iPhone to come sometime in June, with a launch date for the new device sometime in July. Quo is also supporting the claim that Apple will offer a lower cost iPhone along with the updated 5S. iMore also seems to be confirming a summer release for the next generation iPhone, but claims that their checks seem to indicate a date that could be as late as August. As far as the specs on the new phones go, it looks like the iPhone 5S is going to be a marginal bump up from the iPhone 5. Most are expecting a new A7 processor, likely based on a 28 nanometer process. They also are saying it could have a smart flash, meaning the actual physical flash for the camera, also possibly an improved camera system. It depends on the source that you're looking at. I had heard rumors that Apple might be bumping up to a 12 megapixel sensor from the current 8 megapixel sensor, but that's in debate. It should be slightly thinner in the design, and there are rumors that it may have a fingerprint scanner on the home button. Apple acquired a company that specialized in biometrics a while back, and we could finally see some of the fruits of that acquisition in this next generation device. I don't know how excited I am about biometrics on my phone. I guess it's something different other than slide to unlock, but I don't know that it's any kind of quantum leap forward. So looking like an incremental upgrade to the iPhone 5. As far as what the low-cost iPhone might look like, it's assumed that it will use the current generation A6 processor, rumors of a 4-inch Retina in-cell touchscreen display. I figured Apple might bump down on the display a little bit, but the rumors right now are saying it will be a 4-inch Retina screen. The same camera system as the current generation iPhone 5, a 1.2 megapixel FaceTime camera and an 8 megapixel EyeSight camera. The casing is supposedly a plastic and fiberglass case, would be available in 6 colors, and the unlocked pricing would start around $350 US. I think we've also heard rumors of maybe even as low as $330 US, and it would be free on a 2-year contract. Mac Takahara claims that the lower cost iPhone has been pushed back to 2014, though, and they believe it will have a slightly larger display, coming in at 4.5 inches. For those wondering about any new iPads or rumors on those front, the standard fare of recent rumors seems to still apply. There may be new iPads in the April-May timeframe. Most are predicting that the 9.7-inch iPad is the one that's going to get an update, bringing on iPad mini type styling, so the black and slate and white and silver designs in the larger form factor, and that it will be slightly thinner. Beyond the new design styling, we haven't heard too much in terms of next generation specs for the upgrade on the iPad with Retina display. The iPad mini may or may not see an update in April. I think most sources are predicting that Apple's going to stick with the biannual release schedule, with the 9.7-inch happening in the April-May timeframe and the iPad mini updates continuing to happen around the October timeframe. Most believe that the iPad mini will get a Retina screen update when it gets bumped up, and that should happen sometime around October. Since the days of the eMac, Apple has offered a specially priced Mac exclusively for the education market, usually priced, or I think since those days, priced at $1,099 US, so just over $1,000. And this year is no different. As a matter of fact, this week, Apple updated the model that they offer the education market to one of the new iMac designs. At first blush, it seems like a nice bump up from the prior generation EDU model. You get the new 21.5-inch design, which is the 40% thinner. You get double the RAM up to 4 gigabytes from 2 gigabytes. You get double the hard drive up to 500 gigabytes from a 250 gigabyte hard drive. And you get a 3.3 gigahertz dual core i3 processor. That's a bump up from a 3.1 gigahertz processor. Plus, on top of that, it adds the Thunderbolt, USB 3, and Bluetooth 4.0, all while maintaining that EDU $10.99 pricing. And that sounds great until you realize that the EDU price on the base 21.5-inch model, the same one that Apple would sell to us consumers, is just $150 more than the EDU model. And with that, everything is doubled. You get an Intel i5 quad-core processor versus an i3 dual-core processor. You also get 8 gigabytes of RAM versus 4. You get a 1 terabyte hard drive versus a 500 gigabyte hard drive. And you get dedicated NVIDIA GeForce 6400M graphics. So all of that for just $150 more. So I don't know if I really follow what Apple's trying to do. I mean, I get that many educational institutions are really strapped for cash, but it seems like a pretty bad deal when you're just comparing specs. You're better off maybe getting one less iMac in your lab and getting the ones with the better specs. And frankly, would it really kill Apple at this point to help the struggling education market with a real deal and just knock $150 off of that base price 21.5-inch consumer model and offer that up to educational institutions? You know, I did a little checking after I was thinking about this. I was wondering, you know, with all of Apple's cash on hand, that $137 billion, what would it cost them if they wanted to give every K-12 school, and I'm talking about public, private, charter, what have you, every K-12 school in the U.S., 10 iMacs at full retail price. So I did a little poking around. The latest numbers I could get was in 2010, there were 132,656 K-12 schools in the U.S. Apple could buy 10 iMacs at $12.99, the full retail price for every K-12 school in the U.S., and it would cost them roughly $1.7 billion. That's hardly going to even make a dent in their $37.1 billion. And I'm not saying Apple could or even should do that, but it just sort of illustrates, like, could it really kill them to just offer up a really good deal for the education market on some new iMacs? And I wish we'd see them step up. I don't think we are. So we get the $10.99 model. But frankly, if you're an educator, you're an IT buyer for an educational institution, just pay attention to the specs. I know you're smart people, so you'll figure it out. But, you know, pay the extra $150 and get a lot more Mac for your money. For several years now, we've been hearing that Apple has at least been toying around with and maybe possibly getting serious about trying to bring out a streaming music service, iTunes streaming music service. And most of the time when this conversation comes about, we hear that Apple's been struggling to try and make any kind of headway with the music industry in terms of getting a deal in place where it would make streaming iTunes music service possible. Well, citing three people this week who they claim are familiar with the situation, Reuters is reporting that Apple may be looking for a little help from some industry insiders. They supposedly met with the Beats Electronic LLC Corporation. That's Dr. Dre's company who makes, you know, cool headphones and a lot of great audio equipment and gear and stuff like that. They met with the company's CEO, Jimmy Iovine, to discuss a project that Beats had announced, something called called Project Daisy, which is their music subscription service. Beats announced the service back in January, but so far they haven't offered a whole lot of details on the specifics. It's essentially said to be a music service that's developed on the back of the Moog premium subscription music service that Beats acquired back in early January 2012. And so they've taken that and evolved it into this Daisy Music project, which is actually being headed up by CEO Ian Rogers and Trent Reznor of the Nine Inch Nails, who is on the board as their creative director. So it's easy to understand why Apple might be taking an interest in what they're up to over at Beats, because Apple's reportedly been struggling to get support for this music service from the music industry. They've also been struggling with music discovery on iTunes, and a big focus of the Daisy project is reportedly music discovery and customized expert curation of music to make recommendations to subscribers. And they really do have some pretty big, as you can hear, industry heavyweights and insiders who might be able to help Apple break down some of the stalemates that they've been having, or at least reportedly having, right? We don't really know what Apple's up to, but everybody believes they're trying to do this music subscription thing. So when this story broke, when it kind of was discovered that they were talking to the Beats people and Beats had announced that they were working on a subscription service, naturally a lot of the assumptions fell to, well, they're going to do something together and Apple's going to partner and work with Beats to bring a streaming service into iTunes. Well, the reports may have been getting ahead of themselves a little bit or getting worked up a little bit prematurely, because reportedly coming out of this meeting, it was revealed that it was mostly just informational, with the two sides chatting over a whole range of industry-related topics, and that no actual deal was discussed during the meeting. So it sounds like mostly an exchange of information, and it may be related to Tim Cook and the folks at Apple may have wanted to talk to Iovine about some of the things that he felt about why Apple was having trouble breaking in. He had said in a statement that Apple was having trouble with the record companies and getting a deal done because Steve Jobs didn't want to pay enough money to the record industry, and he had this sort of firm belief that eventually the record companies would break down and come down on their pricing, and that hasn't to date seemed to have happened. As a matter of fact, I've read reports that services like Spotify are making big inroads, and they're actually starting to help curb some of the music piracy that's been happening. But I kind of find it hard to believe that they're really doing much to actually raise industry prices or profits. So in some ways, I think maybe Steve Jobs was right. You know, like, these services aren't generating a ton of money. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think they're generating a lot more money suddenly for the music industry, but they're certainly, according to many reports, curbing some of the privacy. So people are opting to pay for a subscription service, making those very attractive to the music industry. So maybe they're going to open up and be more open to deals, but you know, they could still be holding out for money. So I'm imagining that that was a lot of the stuff that was discussed during this meeting. Regardless, I think that the music industry just doesn't want to do any kind of deals with Apple, mainly because of iTunes and how iTunes changed their business model and really changed the industry. I think the record companies have decided that they'd rather do deals with anyone other than Apple, almost no matter how good a deal Apple could offer them. So, you know, if Apple does want to get into the music streaming business sometime in 2013, and that really still remains to be seen. I don't think we've heard definitively that Apple is wanting to do a streaming service, but let's just assume that they do. I think one of their best hopes might actually be some sort of strategic partnership. And even though that really feels unlikely, it could be, again, part of the thing that was being discussed with the Beats folks. But to me, that really doesn't fit Apple's sort of we control it all style. You'd think maybe they'd actually just take some of that money and try and buy their way in. But that's not going to get them, you know, past the sort of tension that they have with the music industry. So if they can go through some sort of intermediary by partnering with another company, that might be their best bet for getting in. We're going to have to kind of keep watching this one and see what happens. I know there's a lot of people out there who would like to see an iTunes streaming music service, but to date, you know, Spotify's getting some pretty good press, and I know a lot of you really like it. So, you know, maybe the question I have is there really room at this point? Is Apple too late to the party to bring out an iTunes streaming media service? Has that ship already sailed? And should we just leave it to some of these other companies like Beats and Spotify to kind of take up the slack for those customers who want that kind of service? At the moment, Android and Apple combined make up 90% of the U.S. smartphone OS market, but over the last 3 months, apparently Apple's gain has been a little bit of Android's loss. According to Comscore's latest mobile lens numbers for the three-month period ending in January 2013, Apple's U.S. share of the mobile smartphone OS market rose 3.5% from 34.3% in October last year to 37.8% in January, Android still maintained a healthy lead in total mobile OS market share in the States, but saw its lead decline 1.3% from 53.6% in October last year to 52.3% in January. Similarly, BlackBerry, Microsoft, and Symbian all saw their three-month mobile smartphone OS share slide, seemingly at the expense of iOS. And while Android does have the majority share of the OS market, Apple is the top manufacturer when it comes to the hardware. Apple actually saw their share rise from 34.3% in October to 37.8% in January. That's up 3.5%. Samsung was the number two manufacturer of smartphones in the U.S. They actually also saw gains of 1.9%, up from 21.4% in January from 19.5% in October. What's really odd, though, as pointed out by 9to5Mac, is that the U.S. carriers reported that the iPhone makes up as many as 66 to 85% of their activations. So you'd think Apple's overall market share numbers would be higher than are generally reported. And I have to say, you know, this is just my, or something that could be my personal bias, but when I'm out and about walking around and looking at the different devices and smartphones that people are using, it feels to me more like two out of three people are on an iPhone versus an Android device, which would seem to support what the carriers are giving out in terms of activation numbers. But, you know, that's just my personal observation, and it's very far from scientific. You tend to, I think, notice the devices that you prefer. So probably if I was an Android fan, I'd be a little bit more skewed in the other direction. But overall, I don't think Apple has much to worry about. They're maintaining a healthy position in both OS and manufacturing market share. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show's sponsors, and that's Gazelle. Do you want a new iPhone or an iPad or maybe even a Samsung Galaxy S? You know, I won't tell. It's okay if you want an Android device. Of course you do, but before you get your new device, or even if you've already upgraded, make sure you sell your used gadget on Gazelle and get some cash for that old device. You could give it away, but, you know, why not get some cash to help cover that upgrade? Gazelle is great because it's really fast, it's simple, it's easy to use. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Tell them a little bit about your device, what you have, a little bit about the condition. They'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads for cash. And when you do that, you plug all that information in, you get a risk-free offer right there on the screen. They'll tell you how much they'll give you for it, and you can lock that offer in for 30 days. And once you accept the offer, you send your device in, they'll check it out, and you get paid fast, either by check or by PayPal. It couldn't be simpler. So just do it today, because your gadgets actually lose value every day that you wait. And the prices fluctuate, and they'll go down the longer you wait, the longer new devices have been out. So they'll lock that offer in for 30 days, giving you time to actually get your new device before you have to send out the old one. They'll even pay for shipping, and in some cases on items, they'll even provide a box for you. So the process is really simple. And once they get it, they process the payment quickly, and you don't have to wait to get your cash. So sell your used iPhone, your iPad, your Mac today at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So on the last show, I had Ken Ray from macOS Ken and David Sparks from MacSparky.com, also the Mac Power Users podcast, on because I wanted to talk a little bit about a lot of the conversation that's been going on in the media, a lot of the negative conversation, I have to say, that Apple has somehow lost its edge. They've lost their ability to innovate. A lot of people are calling into question the job that Tim Cook is doing, and I frankly think the guy's doing a great job. And I think a lot of people forget that he's been running Apple not just for the last year, but really for probably about the last 3 years. You know, Steve was around, but he was very sick in those last few years, and I don't think he was as involved in the day-to-day operations at Apple. That's just my personal sort of perspective or feeling on the thing. I mean, how could he have been? But regardless, you know, Tim Cook was at the helm. He was taking up the reins. So he oversaw the launch of some pretty amazing devices and products. And I think, as I said in that episode, we just need to give Apple and the guys a little bit of time. It's only been really 3 years since they brought out the amazing revolutionary iPad. And so we had a whole conversation about that, and that sparked some of you into action, into discussion. And I received many comments, including this one from Todd.
Hey, Adam, this is Todd Walker. I just listened yesterday to the February 25th episode where you were talking about the whether Apple is doomed and so forth. And I just kind of wanted to drop you a quick message here and give you my thoughts. It was a great episode, by the way, and I enjoyed listening to y'all's discussion. Before I start my comments, let me make it clear. I'm not a Mac pundit. I'm not a stock market guy. I know nothing about finances or anything like that. I'm just a fellow Mac enthusiast. So take my comments from that perspective. As entertaining as it is to, you know, to talk about Mac product cycles and, you know, how often they come out with new products and all that kind of thing, it seems to me that, I don't know, maybe y'all are making it a little more complicated than it really is, or maybe I'm oversimplifying, I don't know, but it seems pretty simple to me. When Steve died in October of 2011, I think that the immediate question on just about everybody's mind was, can Apple continue to innovate without Steve Jobs around? Steve has always been identified as the innovator because he was. And so once he was gone, the question was, can they continue to innovate the way that they have over the last 10, 15, 20 years? The only way for Apple to answer that question is to come out with the next big thing, the next great product, without Steve around. And until that happens, there's going to be this question mark in the mind of the pundits, Wall Street, the general public. So for that reason, I think that the next product that Apple comes out with, and this may be, maybe I'm overstating the importance, but I think that the next product that Apple comes out with, whatever it is, the next new product, the success or failure of that product is going to go a long way to predicting the future of Apple Computer. Because if they come out with a great product that has the same success that the iPhone, iPad have had, then they will have shown the world that they can continue on. Tim Cook and Johnny Ive can run the company just the way it's been run for the last 10 years or so, and they can continue to come out with great products even though Steve is not there anymore. However, if that next product is a flop, and I think that the word flop, you know, Apple has set the bar very high. So a product that may be successful for any other company, for Apple, may be considered a flop. So if that product is not a commercial success the way that the iPhone, iPad, iPod, and so forth have been for Apple, I think it's going to make a lot of people stop and think, you know what? Apple's done. They can't continue down the path that they have been on for the last several years because Steve isn't there anymore. He was the inspiration. He was Apple. And without him, there will be no Apple Computer. Now, is that fair? Of course not. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope that that's not the case. But I think that Apple's next product launch has got to be something big, and it's got to be something great, and it has to be successful. So until that happens, I think that the general public is going to continue to look down on Apple because either A, they don't have anything in the pipeline, so they can't come up with the next big thing if they don't have the next big thing. And why don't they have it? Well, because Steve's not there anymore. That's the only explanation. Or, you know, they're nervous to come out with whatever it is they're working on because they know the importance of it, that sort of thing. So I think that people are going to continue to look negatively at Apple until they come out with whatever their next product is, and then we'll see, you know, how the market reacts. So anyway, I hope I didn't ramble too much. Those are just kind of my thoughts. As always, I enjoyed the show. Thanks.
Hey, Todd, I that you didn't ramble too long at all. I appreciate the comments, and I think they're actually very insightful. I know you said you're not a pundit or an analyst, you're just a fan, but I think you have a pretty good grasp on what's going on, and I completely agree with you. And here's the thing, is I think you're right on all accounts, and it is good and bad depending upon your perspective. And I'm going to tell you in a minute why I think for Apple it really doesn't matter whatsoever. But you're completely right, and I completely agree. Right now, Apple is under more pressure than ever to give the world the most amazing, earth-shattering, groundbreaking, unbelievably outstanding product that will change the fate of the world and everyone in it forever. That is what pundits and Wall Street and everybody is expecting out of Apple. That's what consumers want. That is what their industry peers are looking for them to do. And what is really horrible about all of that is the only result, and the result that everybody seems to want, at least in my mind, is failure. Apple has to fail, because how can it live up to that expectation? The world has set the bar so high for Apple that how can they could bring out the greatest product in the world, and I just have this fear that everybody except us fans and the consumers who love the company and love their products are going to really fail to see it. It will be a failure, at least in the eyes of some. And the question is going to be, how many people are going to be shouting that? The media, in my mind, has been salivating for Apple's demise over the last few years, and they are very likely going to view and do the things necessary to make that story come true, because they love that kind of controversy, to see the giant rise and then watch the giant, or even trip the giant and cause them to fall. You know, there will be those who are going to say that the next product, whatever it is Apple's downfall. It is the sign that Apple has failed, that they have tripped, that they can no longer innovate. They've already started telling that conversation, and I guess that's what I'm getting a little bit frustrated about. And, you know, unless that product, that next great thing, is a transporter, a flying car, a food replicator, you know, something of that caliber, it's not going to be good enough. And so that leaves with the question, well, does Apple care, and really should they? And at the end of the day, the good news is my gut tells me no, they don't. That's not the reason that Apple lives. That's not the reason why Apple is on this planet. And I think those were some of the things that we discussed in that app, in that episode, and more. Apple has or feels no obligation to anyone other than themselves and their customers and their fans to bring out a product. Who they're trying to appease and whose expectations they're trying to build products to and deliver products to are mostly their own. They want to build the products that they love, and they want to build the products that we love, and that's who they care about. They don't care about Wall Street or a pundit or, you know, some writer somewhere. And I guarantee that the next product that they release, I guarantee you, it's going to be something amazing. It's going to be something for sure that Apple feels in their heart, in their gut, the people who worked on that product, they feel and believe that it's something that's worthy to have an Apple logo on it. It is not going to suck, at least not on purpose or by any failure of that they've lost this drive for innovation, that the people suddenly became less smart or less intuitive when Steve left. I know that he was a figurehead and he was a banner and he was a leader, and I don't want to diminish or take away from that, but I also believe that he had this awesome legacy, and he instilled and surrounded himself with these amazing people that all share that vision, and that those people are perfectly qualified and capable of carrying on that vision, despite all of these outside forces that seem to be closing in and working against them. So that doesn't mean that this product is going to be a financial success. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a technological success, or even necessarily that it's going to be something that completely changes the world. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but the thing is, it won't matter, at least not to Apple, as long as they meet that goal, that internal goal, and the goal of their fans and their customers, which is to create really innovative, unique, and amazing products. And I just, in my heart of hearts, I know that they can continue to do that, and they will continue to deliver on that vision. And that's not the analyst's goal, that's not the media's goal, that's not Wall Street's goal. They have some vision or mythological view of Apple that I think is way beyond anything that any company could possibly meet. So it's all about making great products for those customers who appreciate them. And as, you know, Tim Cook likes to say over and over again, it's not about selling the most products or having the most market share or having the biggest stock price. That's just not what gets Apple and their employees out of bed every day. That's not what gets them making iMacs and iPads and whatever the next great thing is, be it an iWatch or a TV or something else completely amazing that we haven't even thought about. So I believe that whatever the next product is, it is going to be panned in the media and by analysts, and it may, you know, cause Apple's stock price to fall even further. Who knows? You know, we're never going to know until the thing actually comes out how people are going to react to it. But I have to say, and I think we also mentioned that in this episode, that, you know, the iPod right out of the gate wasn't necessarily seen as this big, giant commercial success. There were a lot of people that panned that, and it took a while for the world to realize Apple's vision. So a lot of times Apple's sort of out ahead of all of these people. And so at the end of the day, I say it doesn't matter. Apple is going to meet their internal goals for these products, and the rest of the world will figure it out somewhere along the way. And then a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, if the stock price falls and the company, if everybody thinks the company's doomed, and what, you know, we've had this story before. Many of us were around in the 90s. Apple was going out of business. It was horrible. I don't think we're ever going to get to that point again, especially not considering the fact, as Ken pointed out, that Apple has $137 billion of cash on hand. That can keep them going for a very long time through many, many huge failures, or large failures, in my opinion, and they're not going to have those. It's just not what the company does. I mean, you think of some of the quote-unquote worst products that Apple's released, and they're still amazing things. I was just having a conversation today with somebody about the Cube, right? The Apple Cube is an amazing piece of design and engineering. It was by no means a commercial success, but it was something that Apple learned from, and I still firmly believe to this day that we have you know, the iMac and the Mac Mini and unibody MacBook Pros because a lot of the engineering things that Apple learned by developing that product. So the point is that there is a lot of running room, and Apple has been, over the past, you know, several years, hugely successful, vastly successful. And to continue to have the pressure to repeat that and repeat that, no company, I don't think you can point to any corporation that could potentially live up to that. And I'm just going to say, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter. Apple's going to be around for a long, long time. They're going to continue to make these great products, and we're going to continue to love and buy them. And I think that's what Apple cares about. And that's sort of what I care about. You know, as long as they keep doing what they always have and live by those mantras, I am going to be a happy Apple customer, and I'm going to be in the Apple store spending my money. And I think a lot of us share that sort of feeling. And that's kind of cool. There were a couple stories this week that prompted me to want to talk to you about making sure that you're prepared for a recent threat against iOS, against your iTunes account, against your bank account. You could lose money over this. And that threat is your five-year-old. And of course, I'm talking about Apple's settlement of their class action lawsuit from a parent whose kid ran up a $200 bill in in-app purchases when they authorized a download, and then within the window that your authorization maintains, the kid went in and to whatever app he was using and made a bunch of in-app purchases. And that whole fiasco, that whole thing prompted a class action lawsuit. That lawsuit Apple settled this week. They're going to be issuing $5 gift cards to folks who had a claim in that class action. If their damages were more than $5, they're going to be issuing iTunes credit. And for anything over $30, I guess they're going to be sending out cash settlements. So that was one story that hit. A separate but related story was ran over at the BBC. I guess there was another five-year-old, or I guess I don't know if it was a five-year-old in the first case, but in the second story, it was a five-year-old, Danny Kitchen from Bristol, England. He ran up a whopping 1,700 pound bill, which I guess translates to about $2,500 US in iTunes in-app purchase charges after his dad entered his passcode and allowed Danny to download a free iPad game. And then I guess he purchased a bunch of $69.99 pound charges over and over again within a 15-minute period. You know, there's that 15-minute window when you're able to make an in-app purchase without needing to reauthorize your iTunes account. And the link in the BBC case is that the root of this issue tends to be a parent authorizing an app download. It could be a free app, it could be a paid app, and then handing the device over to a child who makes these in-app purchases within that window. And, you know, this could be an honest mistake, especially if you're not familiar with the policy or you're not familiar with how iTunes works. And I guess Apple could be more upfront about doing that. But at the same time, I feel like people should understand their technology a little bit. I mean, it's one of the reasons I do this podcast, probably one of the reasons you listen, is so that you can hear about these sorts of things and avoid these kinds of mistakes, right? Getting to understand technology and know it a little bit better. So I see both sides of the coin, but what I wanted to do and where I wanted to take this for you is, you know, it's pretty easy to prevent this. And all you have to do is go into the settings on your iOS device, go under General and go into Restrictions. And these are, you know, this is where the parental controls are, but you don't necessarily have to have every control turned on. You can just enable these, and you'll see the list in here once you start looking of all the different things that you can control restrictions for. So if you know you have a device that's going to be shared in your family, and especially if you know you're going to be handing it to your children, you may want to enable some of these. And most specifically in this case, you want to enable the restrictions to prevent a child from making an in-app purchase. And it's really easy to do. You just tap enable restrictions. It's going to ask you to set up a passcode. And this is a restrictions passcode. It's separate from the unlock passcode. You're going to set this one up just for getting in and changing the restrictions settings. So you put in a code, you confirm the code, it's a 4-digit code, and then once you're in there and can enable, disable the settings, you're going to want to scroll down a little bit, and you're going to want to change the require password setting. You can change it from the default 15-minute window and have that set to immediately, or you can, in addition or alternately, turn off in-app purchases completely. There's a little toggle there, a little on-off, and just turn in-app purchases off, and maybe that's the only setting you need to set. And then you'll never get hit by an unexpected in-app purchase charge, because it literally won't let you make one without disabling this feature and entering your passcode. So there you go. Now you don't have to get involved in a class action lawsuit. You don't have to worry about your kid running up a bunch of unknown charges on strange in-app purchases. You can download those free apps and not have to worry about it anymore. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, I did get a lot of audio questions from you this week, including this one from Rich.
Enjoy the show. This is Rich. I am absolutely upset that my iPhone 4S does no longer functions with my 10.6.8 Snow Leopard. And I'm wondering if there's a workaround for Mobile Me. I upgraded my stuff, and I used to be able to come in and put my phone down and just basically watch whatever work I had done on it that day, transmit via wireless Wi-Fi to my address book or notes or calendar or anything. I didn't even have to plug it in. Very frustrating speaking with Apple. They admit there's issues. They admit that there's a very big gap with the loss of MobileMe now. And I'm just wondering, I do listen to it a lot, Adam, but I just don't know if there's a workaround that would allow me to, you know, not have to go in to iTunes and plug a cable in and turn stuff off and then back on and then reboot like this nice young lady from Apple was telling me how to. This is not why I bought an Apple. I'm a 25 Blazer from the Quadra 660 AV days, and I've got 7 or 8 Macs and a whole bunch of iPhones, and it's not getting any easier, and I'm trying to figure out why. So love the show. Listen to it religiously. Keep up the good work, and shoot me an answer if you can. Doesn't have to be on the cast. Appreciate you. Take care.
It is going to be on the cast, though, Rich, because that is a problem that I have a feeling you're not just suffering from. It's something that I talked about on the show in the past. It's actually a point of frustration for me because I have an older machine as well. I have a Snow Leopard machine, and you know, Macs are built to last a long time. We have these systems for a long time, and it's one of the reasons why I think a lot of us are Apple and Mac fans. And so when Apple chooses to obsolete a system, in some ways it sometimes feels like they're forcing us to upgrade. Now, it wasn't really clear. I couldn't tell if you were having a iTunes Wi-Fi syncing issue or an MobileMe to iCloud transitioning issue. It sounds like the latter. Like what happened was you have MobileMe, you were using that for syncing in Snow Leopard through the cloud so that you sync your contacts and your notes and your iCals and things like that. And those all happen automatically and sync through the cloud. And what you change on your iOS device shows up on your Mac and vice versa. And that did change when Apple moved from MobileMe to iCloud because iCloud can no longer sync up with macOS 10 Snow Leopard. And so since iCloud is no longer supported under Snow Leopard, it means that your iCloud syncing or your MobileMe syncing is no longer working. And if you turn iCloud on your devices, they're not going to sync through your Mac through iTunes. So I'm assuming that when you contacted Apple, the girl who was helping you out, what she told you was, well, you need to turn off iCloud syncing on your devices, hook up through a cable through iTunes, and then you can sync your contacts over that way through the operating system. But the problem is that means that when you're out and about, if you change something on your iOS device, it's not going to sync through iCloud. So if you have, say, iPad and an iPhone or multiple iPhones, right, it's not going to sync through the cloud and end up on all of the devices. You're going to have to sync those up through iTunes. So your Snow Leopard machine and iTunes becomes the intermediary. Now, you should be able to still use iTunes wireless syncing or Wi-Fi syncing to have that action happen. You shouldn't have to, I don't think, manually connect the cable. But I think that's not what you're going for. So if you want to get over-the-air syncing through iCloud working again, your easiest solution, if possible, and I don't know if this is a possibility for you, would be to upgrade your Mac to macOS 10 Lion or macOS 10 Mountain Lion. But that wasn't really, I don't think, what you were asking me. What you were asking is there some sort of workaround for Snow Leopard? And it turns out there actually is. It's not supported by Apple, so calling up Apple, they're not going to tell you about it. And I can frankly tell you it's not necessarily for the faint of heart because it does involve manually setting up some configurations, but it's not impossible. And the only other thing I'll say is I can't necessarily vouch for its robustness or its reliability, although I did try it out on my old Mac Mini running Snow Leopard, and it did work. I was able to set up all of these methods that I'm going to describe for you. But like I said, they are not supported by Apple, and they rely on the fact that iCloud uses some standard server technology and protocols for connectivity. So what's cool about this is that if you can get clients on other systems, including Windows machines and Linux machines and what have you that connect to these standardized services, then you should be able to use these same techniques to set up those devices. But in your case, let's get you up and syncing through iCloud from your iOS devices to your Mac and vice versa. So probably the areas that you're going to want to sync up, one would be bookmarks. Now, I have to tell you, for bookmark syncing, you are going to sync via iTunes. So you're going to want to disable iCloud syncing in Safari on your iOS devices. The way you do that is you go into your iOS device and you should be able to go into the iCloud settings and turn the toggle off for Safari syncing. It's going to prompt you, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to leave the data on your device? I think you want to leave the data on your device, and then you're going to attach your device to your Mac via iTunes through the cable, and then under the info tab, you know, so go into iTunes, select your device in iTunes, and under the info tab, you're going to want to check the option to sync your Safari bookmarks. And then perform a sync. That's going to sync your bookmarks from your iOS device back to your Mac and vice versa. And then once you've done that, you can go back into iCloud on the device and turn iCloud for Safari back on. And then you should have everything synced back up. And then once you're out and about, if you add a new bookmark in Safari, that'll sync up to iCloud, and it will sync out to any of your other iOS devices you have hooked into iCloud. The only disadvantage there now is if you want to sync a bookmark back from Safari on your Mac or back to your Mac, vice versa, you're going to have to go through this whole rigmarole of turning off iCloud, syncing, and turning it back on. So that's the one of these processes that's going to be a little bit more manual for you. But your other types of syncing, your calendar syncing, your contact syncing, and email, that should work pretty much just like it would as if you were on iCloud on OS X Lion or Mountain Lion, but you are going to have to do some additional configuration. So let's start with your calendars. iCloud uses the CalDAV protocol. That's that standardized protocol. So the trick here is knowing how to configure iCal on your Snow Leopard machine, which supports connecting to a CalDAV server to work directly with iCloud's CalDAV server. So the easiest way to set this up is to open up Safari, go to iCloud.com, log into your iCloud account, and then go into the calendar application. And then once you're in there, pick any one of your calendars, and you'll see a little, it looks almost like a Wi-Fi icon, on a little circle for, and it's actually the sharing icon. Go ahead and click that on, and then that'll bring up the sharing window for that calendar, and then click on public, and then click on the share link. Now, we're not going to click OK to actually enable public sharing of the calendar. You just need to turn that on so you can access some information that's going to be there. So when you hit the share button, it's going to show you a URL. And you're going to want to make note of the number that is after the first P character in that URL. So it'll be a long cryptic URL string, but the only thing that we're looking for is something that'll look like P02 or P03 or P04, might be P01. It's that 01020304 number that we're looking for. So look at that, make a note of that, and then you can cancel out of sharing the calendar or unshare the calendar. All you need is that number. And once you have that number, then you can go back to your Mac, launch iCal, and then what you're going to do is you're going to create a new account. So you're going to go into the iCal preferences, say you want to add an account, and choose to add a CalDAV account. And then using your iCloud username, that's your full iCloud email address, the one you use for logging into iCloud, and password, you're going to put that information in. And then in the server field, when you're setting up this CalDAV connection, you want to use the URL P and then that number that you noted down. So let's just say, for example, it was 03. You're going to type in P03-CalDAV, CalDAV iCloud.com, and you're going to put that in as the server URL. And then make sure that for the port number, you put 443 and check on the option to use SSL encryption. So check that on, and then go ahead and click OK, and you now should have a new iCal calendar for your at iCloud or at me account, whatever your email address was that you logged into iCloud with. And you should now at that point be able to sync your calendar over the air, and it should work just as if you had set it up under the calendar application on Mountain Lion or on Lion. And that's it. That's all there is to it. So why Apple can't enable this by default for Snow Leopard users and just have it built in, I have no idea. But that's the workaround for calendars. The workaround for contacts or for your address book is very similar. It's a little bit more tricky, but again, it uses a standard protocol. It uses the CardDAV protocol. So you can kind of see the common thread. This uses all the DAV protocols. And the only disadvantage of setting up CardDAV in the address book application is that it's going to require you to store your iCloud password in the settings inside the address book application in the clear. So just be aware of that. If you're uncomfortable with that, you might not want to proceed with setting up your contacts. But it's relatively safe. And again, you're going to turn on SSL for when you're making the authentication to Apple's servers. So that's the encryption, just like you would see the little lock in Safari when you're using a banking website or making a purchase on Amazon or something like that. It's going to use a similar technology. So it's going to be encrypted as it's making that authorization. It's just in the settings, if someone were to get into your Mac and look in your address book settings, they could potentially see your iCloud password in there. So what you're going to do is you're going to go back and you're going to open up iCal, and you're going to go to its account preferences, and you're going to go to that iCloud CalDAV account that you set up earlier. And when you go in there, you're going to want to make note of the server path field, which should now be filled in. And within that field, it should have a path, basically, and it'll have a slash and then a long number, which is actually your iCloud ID number. And then it's going to say slash principal. So you're going to want to copy that server path field, make note of it, copy it, and then you can get out of iCal and you're going to go back to the address book application. And once again, you're going to go into the preferences, you're going to go to accounts, and you're going to create a new account. And in this case, you're going to create a CardDAV account in the address book preferences. And you're going to, for your username, put in your username and then %40, which is actually the at symbol, but URL encoded. So it'll be your iCloud username, %40 at mac.com, and then a colon, and then you're going to want to put in your iCloud password. And this is the point in the settings where it's going to be in the clear. So you're going to fill that in as the username for this account. And then if you have in the password section, if your password has any special characters, so like an at symbol or a slash or a greater than or less than, you're also going to need to make sure that you convert that. You're going to need to URL encode that to its character. So just like you replaced the at symbol in your username with a %40, you're going to need to figure out the URL encoded value for any special characters that are in your password. If you just Google for URL encode, you'll be able to find a tool online that should allow you to put in whatever that special character is and then have it converted to the URL encoded character you're going to have to replace it with. So replace any of the special characters in your password with the encoded characters, and then plug all of that in, the username plus the colon plus the password, into the username field when you're setting up your CardDAV account. And then in the password field, you just want to hit the space bar. So you're going to put in a single space. You'll see a single bullet character appear in that field, and that's all you're going to enter in the password section. And then For the server URL, once again, you're going to change the front part. You're going to put in P and then that 03 number or whatever it is, whatever the equivalent was for your account, the same one that you used when we set up your iCal. So in this case, for the server name, using our same example, if we were P03, you're going to put in https://p03-contacts.icloud.com:443. That's for port 443. And then you're going to paste in that slash with your iCloud user ID slash principal server path that you copied over earlier. So paste that in, so that full URL. And if you need more details on all this stuff, I'll have it in the show notes at maccast.com, so you can just follow along the step-by-step. But you're going to plug that in, and then you're going to hit OK to create the account. Now, you're very likely going to get an error message. It'll probably be a 404, or possibly I got a 403 error message. That's normal. You can ignore this and just go ahead and click the create button again, and that should set up the account in the address book application. So once you've got all that set, you can go ahead and go. It'll drop you back into the account preferences. You'll probably want to add a description, so something like iCloud contacts or iCloud account or what have you. Plug that in and then get out of the account settings and go ahead and quit and relaunch the address book. And it should then at that point connect up to the iCloud server and pull down and sync all of your contacts. So now you'll have your contacts set up or your address book set up. So iCal set up, address book set up. And then the last thing that you'll want to set up to get all of your iCloud syncing in place would be your email and your notes. And you may already have this set up because the email didn't change. If you were set up to connect to the MobileMe email server, email should be working. But in case you don't have it set up, iCloud's email services use the standard IMAP protocol and therefore can be accessed very easily from most email clients, including Mac's Mail app. So you'll open up Mail, go into Preferences, select the Accounts tab, choose to create a new account, and then all you have to do is plug in your iCloud username and password. There's no special mojo or anything like that for this. Click Continue. It should connect to Apple servers and set up your IMAP account. In case you're wondering, it's going to use imap.mail.me.com as your email server and smtp.mail.me.com as your outgoing email server. But it should set itself up, and then the mail application is used for syncing both your email and your notes. And so that's how you set all of that stuff up if you're under Snow Leopard. And I hope that helps you out. I know it's not as easy as it should be. I totally get your point, Rich, about this isn't why we signed up to be Mac users. I'm really frustrated that Apple is not updating Snow Leopard to take advantage of the iCloud services, and I really question why they're doing that. To me, it feels like they're forcing people to upgrade to Lion or Mountain Lion, and they're using this as sort of that dangling carrot to get you to move forward, and I certainly don't agree with it. And then finally for this week, I received a question from Zach, who wanted to know about keyboard shortcuts, and more specifically, doing something that I had never thought about before, which is actually removing a default keyboard shortcut. Here's the question from Zach.
Hi, Adam. My name is Zach, and I have a question. I have a really bad habit of closing windows with Command-W in Safari and closing the active window, and I wondered, is there a way to modify the keyboard shortcut for just Safari so I don't disable the Command-W and the rest of the operating system? So I tried using the shortcuts, keyboard shortcuts, and I made a new thing for Safari for the closed window, and that didn't seem to work. So I made a new key command of different keys for the closed window command or the menu. And it didn't work. So I wondered, is there a way to edit the command keys for just Safari? And we met over in Petaluma at the Mac event, and had a nice chat. looking forward to hearing the answer online.
Hey, Zach. Well, yeah, it was a great meeting you at the Mac Computer Expo, the great event up there. And if you ever have a chance to go out there, I would encourage you. It's a lot of fun, and you get to meet cool people like Zach. But Zach, you know, you were on the right track where you were going into the system preferences into keyboard and then adjusting the keyboard shortcuts. And of course, you can adjust the shortcut for just a single application like Safari. What you'll do is once you're in that keyboard shortcuts tab, click the little plus button. Well, first you want to select the application shortcuts from the list on the left, and then click the little plus icon to add a new shortcut. And it sounds like that's exactly what you were doing. And then in the dialog that pops up from the application dropdown, you'll choose Safari as the application you want to add a new shortcut to. And then for the menu, that's where you will enter close window. So the word close, space, and then window with a capital C in the word close and a capital W in the word window. And the reason that it needs to be entered exactly like that is you have to spell it exactly as it appears in the Safari file menu. And this goes for any keyboard shortcut that you're going to add for any application or even system-wide. It has to be typed out in here exactly the way it appears in the menu. And I'm sure you were doing that, but once you plug that in, you set the shortcut value for, you know, what you want to change it to. And I'm assuming you, what you were doing is what I would do, which is set that shortcut to something that you're unlikely to accidentally type and something that's not going to conflict with another shortcut that's already in Safari. So for example, if you're wanting to change the command W shortcut to something that you're not going to accidentally type, you might type in command plus option plus control plus shift plus W as the new keyboard shortcut. And that should override the close window in Safari. Now, where you may have run into trouble is that if you use tabs in Safari, the shortcut actually changes once you have tabs open. So by default, with no tabs, Command W closes the Safari window. Once you have tabs, that keyboard shortcut becomes a different one. It becomes Command Shift W to close the main Safari window, and the Command W shortcut is changed for the close tab option. So probably what you needed to do was not only set the shortcut for close window, you probably also wanted to remap the shortcut for close tab. So repeating the same steps, you would add an override for close space tab with a capital C in the word close and a capital T in the word tab, and maybe set that to command option control shift T or something like that. And then once you've done that, you may also need to quit and reopen Safari to see your new shortcuts. But that should have allowed you to remap the default ones and set them to something you wouldn't accidentally hit with the Command W just for the Safari application. Now, to kind of follow up a little bit further on your question, there is no way to, at least through the system preferences, set a default shortcut to be nothing or to remove a default shortcut. So say you just wanted to simply say, you know, for Safari, I don't want Command W or I don't want the close window option to have any shortcut, and I don't want the close tab option to have any shortcut. You have to actually put in an override for a default shortcut. You can't sort of undo that. Except it turns out that you actually can if you're willing to do a little terminal hacking. So I did a little research on this and found that basically when you're doing system preferences keyboard and going into keyboard shortcuts and overriding these things, what it appears to really be doing is just running a command that adds a dictionary entry to the application's system or to the application's preferences file, to its plist file, and it's adding an NS user key equivalence dictionary entry. And this is just an entry of the overridden keyboard shortcuts that you as a user have entered for that application, which is why I think it's called NS user key equivalence. That's the name of the key that gets inserted into the preference list, into the preference file for the app, the plist file. And so armed with that knowledge, I did a little more digging and found that there is, you can use the standard defaults rights com.apple. In this case, Safari command to add in a entry into the plist file, an NS user key equivalence entry, and then you can set up whatever keyboard shortcut you want. So this is a whole terminal command. I'll have details in the show notes at maccast.com, but basically if you wanted to add one for closed window, the full command that you would type into the terminal would be defaults space write WRITE space com.apple.safari. And you could do this for any application. So after that com.apple, if it's an Apple application, dot, say you wanted to do this for iCal, it'd be com.apple.iCal, I believe. You'd have to double check me on that. I only did the research for Safari. But in this case, you're going to write defaults, write com.apple.safari space N as in next, S as in step, user key equivalence, and that's all one word with a capital U for user, a capital K for key, and a capital E for equivalence. So it's got that camel casing. So defaults write com.apple.safari NS user key equivalence, and then a space dash dict, D-I-C-T for dictionary, dash add. And then you would add in after that a space and then the command that you want to add a shortcut for. So in this case, it would be in quotes, close space window. And then after that, you'd put another space and enter the value you want for that keyboard shortcut. And in this case, if you use a value of nil, N-I-L, and you would put that in quotes as well, that's going to nullify or nil out the keyboard shortcut for close window. So again, full commands will be in the show notes at maccast.com, but just for review, defaults, write com.apple.safari, NS user key equivalence, dict, add, close window, nil. And so you put in that command, hit enter, and that will add an NS dictionary entry with an override for the close window. You would again want to repeat that same thing, but for the close tab option, and then zero out or set the value of those keyboard shortcuts for those two entries to be nothing. And you can also use this same technique to add a keyboard shortcut for any of the menu items. And for the special characters, if you need to enter those in, you use an at symbol for the command key on your keyboard shortcut. You use the tilde symbol for the option key, the dollar sign for the shift key, and a caret for the control key. So if you wanted to set the command back to be command W for close window, you would, instead of putting in nil as the shortcut value, you would put in the at symbol and the letter W inside the quotes. And if you'd like to see any of the existing NS user key equivalent values that are already assigned for a specific application, you can type the command defaults space read space com.apple dot, in this case again, Safari space NS user key equivalence into the terminal, hit enter, and it will return back inside the terminal the dictionary entries, the NS user key equivalence dictionary items or entries that are in that plist file. So you can see any of these that you've already set up. And you can tell that this is linked into the keyboard preferences, the keyboard shortcut preferences, because if you go in there and put in a new keyboard shortcut and then come back to the terminal and hit this defaults read command, it will kick back that entry that you just added in through the system preferences. So it's kind of cool to see, to go back and forth and see, oh, if I change a thing here, it changes over there. Now, unfortunately, there's no way to easily delete an entry from the NS user key equivalence dictionary from the terminal. There's actually no delete command. So, you know, when we add a new entry, we say ns user key equivalents dash dict for dictionary dash add. There is no dash dict dash delete. So the only way to kind of undo these, if you want to remove an item from the list, you'll have to either read or, you know, print out the full current list and then add back in the items you want, but leave out the one you want removed. Or you can actually delete the entire NS user key equivalents dictionary by using the command defaults space delete space com.apple.safari space NS user key equivalents, and that will delete all of your user keyboard shortcuts for that application and return it back to its factory, you know, sort of default settings. So it probably doesn't need saying. This is pretty technical, and hopefully I didn't lose any of you there, but I'm going to say this anyway. Hacking in the terminal like this can have consequences. If you make a mistake, if you do something wrong, it could cause your application and your system to become a little bit unstable. So back up before you try any of this, and be aware that if you mess up, it could cause some troubles on your system. So definitely not for the faint of heart, but if you absolutely are like, I need to just null out or get rid of the keyboard shortcut for a specific command, it is possible, and that's how you do it. And so with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on their software as well as trials over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and enter the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your iPhone, your iPad, your MacBook, your Samsung Galaxy S, and other smartphones are worth over at gazelle.com. Squarespace, the beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform that allows anyone to easily create a professional website, web page, blog, online store, or gallery all on a single platform. You can try it free, no credit card required. Just head to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now. Plus, if you make a purchase, you can get 10% off your order by using the offer code MACCAST3. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments or FTP by using ShareFile. You can try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. As you could hear from this episode, I love getting your audio comments. I love getting emails and questions. Anything you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MACCAST, send those along. I'll do my best to help you out. The email address is maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave voicemail on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, all the details on anything that I talked about on this or any other episode, along with links, you can find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. I'm also on Google Plus. Just do a search and you'll find me there. It's MACCAST on Google Plus as well. And I look forward to seeing you online, but that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.